I can say one thing. For a poet, you really have staying power, don't you? Poets apparently don't burn themselves out that easily, huh?
No, they're a stubborn bunch.
I noticed in your book, you write a lot about your Baltimore days, and that's a city I admire very much, a city I worked in, I guess, long after you left, or not, maybe not too much longer after you left. It was in the mid-60s, and I worked at WMAR-TV, which was Channel 2 in Baltimore.
Yeah.
It was owned by the Baltimore Sun. And so I had about 3 or 4 years in Baltimore, and I enjoyed it.
Would you have known Mencken?
I did not know Mencken. Mencken died in 1956.
56, yeah. I knew him some before his death.
Oh. Strangely, I just published a book about Mencken. It came out 2 weeks ago. It's a thriller in which Mencken plays detective. It's set in 1948.
What's it called?
It's called The H.L. Mencken Murder Case.
Oh, I'll have to look that up.
Published by St. Martin's Press. Just came out. And I've had 4 reviews so far. 3 were good, but the one of the Baltimore Sun, I understand. I haven't read it yet, but I understand they didn't like it. but I guess if you enjoy the good reviews, you have to take the bad ones as well. Isn't that true?
Yeah, I'm afraid so. And everybody knows, I think, that reviews are completely unpredictable. You can't ever, and the publishers know that very well. And the authors also.
Tell me, in what context did you know Mencken? What was that like?
Well, I was teaching at Hopkins, and he was a good friend of the professors because of the American language. He came to the campus once in a while. Talk, and then I was once at a luncheon that was given by one of the DuPont ladies for Mencken. I forget the occasion, but I remember the pheasant under glass. Mm. and Mencken was delightful. Another time, I wrote a poem about Mencken, which I think I've published somewhere. It was a prose poem, in which he said something. So it sounds ghastly nowadays. He took me to a big restaurant, a big seafood restaurant, and everybody knew him. Everybody in Baltimore knew him by on sight. And he had a loud, booming voice. And in the middle of this, the waiters were black waiters standing around. And in the middle of this lunch, Mencken said in a very loud voice, "There's been one revolution in my lifetime. Niggers have stopped stinking." And there was a dead hush all over this huge restaurant. And he went on as if, you know, it's just ordinary conversation. But I'm sure he did it for effect. You know, he was something of a almost a burlesque type in a way. He was on stage.
And, but I've read most of his work, or at least a great deal of it, and he never had any ethnic characterizations in his work that I can recall.
What was more or less current at the time? Remarks about Jews, Italians, Negroes, and they just rolled off at everybody's tongue. And there were apparently no protests in those days that I can remember.
But it wasn't your feeling that Mencken himself was a racist, was it?
I don't think so. Although his terminology in his books is rather on the low side when he's dealing with situations like that. But his range of contempt, as you know all this very well, was so wide. He included all of Congress and the Supreme Court and presidents, and so everybody was a boob practically, except a few geniuses like Sinclair Lewis.
And Dreiser.
And Dreiser.
Mencken had a number of nicknames. Maybe you can verify this. In my research, I found out that various people in various times had various nicknames for him. He was known as Mink. He was known as H.L. Some people called him Henry, and some people called him Harry. So in my book, I don't refer to him by name. It's only in the title. The editor wanted the name Mencken in the title for commercial reasons. But I thought it would be kind of an interesting game to play, not actually identifying Mencken in the book at all, but making people figure out over a period of time who he was. So I refer to him in the book as Harry. I know from my research that some people did call him Harry. But I understand from the phone call I got that the Baltimore Sun Reviewer said that I didn't know very much about Mencken because nobody ever called him Harry. You didn't call him Harry, did you?
No.
Too bad. I would have living proof that somebody called him Harry. Well, let's talk about you and your Baltimore days. This book, I understand the younger son is only the beginning of a trilogy about your life. Tell me about why you decided at this stage to write so personally.
Yes, I'm not sure how personal it is. This is the only book I've ever written that I don't have a perspective about, and so I'm especially curious about the reaction that what people tell me who have read it and what the reviewers say. I think poets, although many of them would deny this, tend to be very autobiographical, and the harder they try not to be, the more autobiographical they become. So in the past, I've written a lot of poems directly out of my experience as an American, Middle Atlantic American Jewish writer, Baltimorean, and so on. A lot of my poems have to do with Baltimore. But this book came about in a rather curious way. My wife and I were married only a few years ago, and we had known each other since 1940, but had been separated, except vague connections, for almost all those decades. And when we came together again a few years ago, I was still teaching in California, and she was living in New York, and I would write her about five or six pages a day, trying to fill her in on what had gone on with me for the past 40 years. That's really the origin of the book. And it was a letter writing exercise. Mm-hmm. It's a letter, it's a 700-page letter. And the editor has the other 500 pages or so, which he will publish, I don't know when, but maybe a year or so from now.
And decided to make it into three separate books instead of one large one.
Yeah, his idea was to split it up. My way of writing it was I had no idea of writing an autobiography. I've never really had any interest in that as a form of writing. Mine was all achronological, and it works by association that I begin to make a point, for example, but then forget what the point is if I'm distracted by something on the periphery, which is more or less related to the point. Sometimes I never come back to the point at all. But this is the matter. It just spun itself out like that. The whole thing was written. I never did any rewriting. The editing is terrific. What the editor had to do, I don't know if you know this man, Lewis Rubin, in Chapel Hill, he's a well-known critic on Southern writers especially, and he founded the Algonquin Press of Chapel Hill. But what he did was to separate out all the material having to do from the time I was about to be drafted in the peacetime army all through the war up to my discharge, so that this book does read like a narrative. I mean, it does have I'm sure it has a continuity, maybe even a chronology.
Oh, it doesn't.
Which was unintentional on my part.
So what he did, he took all of your letters or manuscripts about your life over this 40-year period and culled from them to put it together in a kind of a chronological order.
Yes, and it was his idea to make it into a kind of almost a wartime book with the photographs and the subtitle of The Youth and War Years of an American book. It seems to me that he brought it off very well. Everybody who has read it has said the same, including the editor, that once they started reading it, no matter how reluctant they were, people don't really like to read autobiographies, I think, that they couldn't put it down, that it flows very fast.
It's seamless. It really is seamless.
Yeah, well, thank you. I think that was the idea.
Now,
in fact, when I wrote it, the original manuscript didn't even have any punctuation. And he must have worked like hell to put all those periods, commas, and semicolons.
It was a big burden on him. What was his name again?
Louis Rubin.
And he is he editor-in-chief?
He's the head of the Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill.
Didn't they just merge with Workman?
Yeah, right. Press? Right. Yeah, you saw him. Yeah, he needed a better distributor, he said. Yeah.
Now, is your wife in the book? Would I recognize her?
Later on.
You said you met her in 1940. And, of course, this book takes us up to about 1944.
When I'm discharged in 45.
Yeah, after your discharge.
Yeah.
So you had met her at this time, but she's not in this particular book. Is there a reference to her that I would recognize?
I don't think in this one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there is a passing reference. Another point is that almost all the characters in this book who are real people are either not named or they're not fully described. They're only sketched in. They're sort of abstract, including the members of my family who will probably resent my treatment of them. They're sort of shadowy in the background, because what I'm really talking about is my discovery of poetry, desire to write it and become a poet, and it's really the progress of a poet.
And it should be pointed out that the name Carl Shapiro is in the book only once, and that is in connection with your at some point reading a novel in which the narrator says something to the effect, I read, it sounds like a poem by Carl Shapiro or something like that. I can't remember the exact context, but that, I think, was the only reference to yourself directly. But at least, in doing it the way you did, there are no I's. It's all third person.
Yeah, that's the big question in autobiographical books. The I is always suspect. Almost every autobiography I've ever read about, even by the best critics, always seem to be suspicious of the veracity of the author. I mean, even autobiographies of Yeats, and so people say, well, it's a pack of lies. All biographies are like, I rhymes with lie.
Mm-hmm.
And autobiographers are afraid of that, generally, of the first person singular, and they try to do something, either fictionalize it or the third person, as I use it here, which I call the fourth person. I'm trying to get far enough away from the I to really be able to tell the truth and be objective. I think I succeeded, but I'm no judge of that.
Well, nobody will know if you succeeded in telling the truth. I mean, that's something that is between the poet. That's something that belongs to the poet. We can only speculate. But if I were going to write my autobiography, and I certainly wouldn't because I have nothing of interest to tell about, I would fictionalize it, because that way I could truncate characters, I could combine characters, I could add characters, I can make dialogue more snappy, I could do things like that. It would still be approximately accurate. It's said that Langston Hughes, in his two volumes of autobiography, did essentially that. I was talking to his biographer, Arnold Rampersad, the other day, and nothing in Hughes' biography is the truth, according to his biographer. He made up everything. He made up dates. If he didn't know a date, he just put a date down. You know, he made up people, changed names, amplified on incidents, and nothing. But yet he built it as an autobiography. But it wasn't. Well, let's talk a little bit about
like Hughes, if you're habituated to writing poetry, the naked truth is not very interesting, and you allegorize it, or you extrapolate, or you build on it. It's a strange form of writing, though. I mean, all the great confessions and books about oneself in the past, and there are hundreds of them, but they all seem to be in a genre slightly outside the realm of literature itself. It's almost in another dimension.
You're talking about biography. Autobiography.
Because it's because it's neither fiction, and on the other hand, it's not statement of fact either. And
it can't really be statement of fact to any great degree, because, and this is not a put down, autobiographies, to a certain degree, are self-serving, because the writer doesn't want to put himself in a position that makes him look bad or awkward, unless it goes with growing up or something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
In other words, at the end of the book, you want to come out looking pretty good. Isn't that true? You don't want to look like a heel.
My editor said that I treat myself pretty rough in here. Now, I tended to agree with him. That was not intentional, but I think I have it may be a mild form of insanity, but I think I have an ability to really get outside myself. That's not considered normal. I mean, the expression "besides yourself" means something else. But I think in the case of this kind of writing, I found that it was possible to do that. Now, this means that you have to discard your self-esteem to a certain extent. I mean, if you were going to look at yourself the way you think others see you, you're sacrificing some of your self-esteem.
And privacy. I mean, you talk about early sexual exploits. A lot of people wouldn't talk about that. Except in locker room, maybe, but to write about it.
I thought that was pretty common in books nowadays.
Yeah, it is common nowadays, but you can fictionalize it, you know, and say, well, that didn't happen to me. But let's talk about some of the things in your book and why you became a poet. Here you're in a middle-class family, and at an early age you, in fact, did publish, self-publish a book of poetry. So tell me, what led you to want to write this form of literature?
Well, for one thing, as I try to put across, it's both a self-fulfillment and an escape. Now, the escape psychology plays a big part, I think, in all poets' lives. What you're escaping from your immediate circumstances and condition, and you're escaping into a fantasy world. As all poets say, you remake the world, you know, nearer to your heart's desire and so on, as Yeats said. So in order to maintain your stability, you have to play a role, say, within your family or within society or in a school or in any kind of social community, in which you are both a part of the group and apart from it. So poets are always looked at with suspicion, as you know, because are considered crazy and frequently are. I think for that reason, because poets are never really close the contact with the world, because they always keep a distance or maintain this kind of state of separation or divorce from the standards and values of almost everybody around them.
It also takes a certain amount of ego, doesn't it, to say, look, I've written this line, I've written these lines, I've written this verse, and I want the world to read it.
Yeah, a tremendous amount of ego.
That and must have been what prompted you then to self-publish this first book of poetry. Tell me how that came about.
Well, I was writing imitations of classical poets and contemporary poets that I discovered, like William Carlos Williams and W.H. Auden, who was a great discovery for me, and trying to find out if I could write as good as, you know, they could, and if I could develop my own voice, which is the big trick of all. I mean, once you have created a voice, a language of your own, a style of your own, you're really on your way, and you can get stuff down that's characteristic and so on. Well, I put together a bunch of these efforts of mine. It was a small book, but none of the poems, there wasn't one poem in there that I would have saved for a book that I printed 10 years later. So it's what they call a vanity book. And
did you go to a printer and say, hey, look, I have these poems, will you print them for me?
I had an uncle who was in Baltimore who was a custom house broker, one of whose customers was a publishing company that printed medical books, Williams and Wilkins, they were called. It was a big posh kind of place. They never published any poetry, but my uncle asked them if they would publish his little book of poems of mine, and he put up the money. It was only a few hundred dollars, I think, or less than that. So they did that, and I presented them with my idea of what a title page should look like, because they were going to use a church Gothic for the, you know, poems with in Gothic. Right? I took them a new book of poems by D.H. Lawrence, which was published in England, and told them to see if they could copy the type for the title page. And anyhow, so there were 200 copies of this book printed, and I signed them all, and sold about maybe a dozen or so, and gave some away and kept the rest, which all disappeared while I was in the Army. I didn't know whatever happened.
There'd be a collector's item a day.
Well, they are. I've seen advertisements for them. In fact, the Xerox company put out a facsimile of one a few years ago without telling me about it. And
how nice of them.
Yeah, I wrote them a letter, and they sent me a contract.
And a photocopying machine. Of course, your first commercially published work was in a collection, I think, called Five Young Poets.
Yeah, that was a very good kind of anthology that New Directions did. They would choose five poets, and each one would have almost enough poems for a separate book. And I was in one of that series. Also, the editor, the publisher, James Laughlin, wanted each poet to write a kind of a statement of poetics. And I wrote a one-page thing about what I was up to, you know, what are you trying to do with these poems? But that was the beginning of my critical reputation, such as it was, because it was reviewed, my part of the book was reviewed very well. And from then on, I didn't have much trouble getting poems published in the good magazines.
For sure. Education as a civilian was interrupted by the war. You drafted into the Army in 1940, I believe. Isn't that, was it 1940?
Yeah. 40? Yeah, there was a peacetime draft, yeah, which most people have forgotten about. But I got caught in it at the beginning and was in the Army almost up to the time of Pearl Harbor. We were about to be released when Pearl Harbor happened, so then I was in for the duration.
Yeah.
But I had left, I had gone to Johns Hopkins. This kind of stuff takes a bit of space in this book, on a scholarship, which I got on the basis of that little book of poems I published. I'd sent the book of poems to one of the English professors at Hopkins, a wonderful man named Hazelton Spencer. Spencer asked to meet me, and we met at the B&O station, and he said he would try to get me a scholarship, which he did at Hopkins. It was a two-year scholarship. But at the end of the second year, I had to make all top grades in order to stay. But I got one not top grade on a history final, and that wiped me out. So then I went to the library school of the Enoch Pratt Library and was going to be a librarian when I was drafted.
You have an interesting character in Mother Sergeant. It's probably the first homosexual sergeant I've run across in the Army.
Well, we were in the medical corps, and there was quite a bit of that. And even though the Army was very rough on these people, they gave them what they called a Section 8. It was something like a dishonorable discharge if they were ever discovered. But in the medical corps, because of the composition of, I guess, people who had worked in hospitals or were orderlies and so on, I don't know. We had quite a few in our outfit, and nobody was ever harassed, but everybody called the sergeant mother.
Well, in spite of the fact that you the war came out, you were a medic, that didn't stop your work as a poet, did it?
No, on the contrary. It was one of the most amazing things, and in ways other than patriotic, I was very grateful to the Army. They enhanced my writing career. But I was a company clerk because I'd had a couple of years of university, they thought I was a good typist or something. So they put me behind a typewriter. Well, I always had the materials for writing, and I don't know what civilians think about how much time soldiers have, but it seems to me that soldiers have endless amounts of empty time in which to do practically anything they want, as long as they don't break the law. And so I spent all my time writing poems, and we got as far as New Guinea, and I would send them to a girl I was engaged to, who would send them to magazines, and who finally actually moved to New York to try to get my books published, and succeeded. So I did something which I believe is quite unusual, maybe unique. While I was in the Army during the war, I published 4 books, one of which won the Pulitzer Prize. And so by the time I got home, I was what they call an established poet.
You were quite a celebrity in the Army, too, weren't you? By being a published poet. That's rare.
Yeah, in a small way. I mean, the Signal Corps took pictures of me like this picture here. And they would have little things in what was the newspaper called Stars and Stripes, I think it was. When I'd win a prize or something like that. So.
Well, you don't tell about the Pulitzer and the younger son that must come in the second volume.
Yeah.
What was it like winning that award? How did you find out about it?
Well, there's a long section in there in which I call the Pulitzer Prize the Golden Albatross, because this prize does all kinds of strange things to the recipients. For instance, whenever I am mentioned in a newspaper, invariably the designation is Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, and that's supposedly settles a lot of questions. Well, it does. It pigeonholes you in a certain way. It's an identification. But I think it was because of that prize that I got the good jobs I subsequently did in universities. When I became a poetry consultant at the Library of Congress, that was really a little piece of political engineering by Alan Tate, who had been an early admirer of mine, and who was one of probably the best critic in the United States, poetry critic in the United States. And he had that job at the Library of Congress, and he asked me if I wanted it.
Didn't Archibald MacLeish have that same job?
MacLeish was a librarian. Oh. He was the big boss.
Oh, I see.
The consultants are on a temporary basis. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, the consultant is also the poet laureate. Mm-hmm. The present one is Howard Memorov.
What do you
and
do as
a two-year? Well, that's what I asked when I got there. I said, "What do you do in this job?" And nobody seemed to know. So I made up work. In fact, I'd been accused of creating a job where there wasn't a job. And I did things like bibliographies and prosody or versification, and tried to examine and build up the massive collections in the Library of Congress with an emphasis on contemporary poetry, and get poets to come and read and record their work. I was the one who got Eliot to record The Wasteland, which I'm very proud of. We had some Rockefeller money, and we had a good studio in the library, but Eliot, who just won the Nobel Prize, did the recording in New York. I don't know at which studio, but that recording was the most famous one that all the poets ever did. And Eliot insisted, being a good businessman, insisted on a contract with royalties. And nobody else ever got any royalties except Eliot. But he was right, because this was the only one that ever sold.
Well, it would seem to me, not since the second and third volumes haven't come out yet, it's kind of like a cliffhanger. I want to try to find out what happened next. But it would seem to me the consulting job there might stand in the way of your own work to some degree. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think you're right. I put in a lot of time there, and I did some writing while I was in Washington, but not as much as I did in the Army.
Yeah, it's kind of like a reward for what you've done up to this point. And you were such a young man. I mean, you couldn't have been much more than your early 30s at that time. And it's like, well, it's time for me to retire. I've got all the I've got the Pulitzer, I've got the Liberian job. What more do I have to do?
Then I was having a family by then, and I knew I needed to get a job. But as a result of the Library of Congress job, I got an appointment at Johns Hopkins as an associate professor right off the bat. And I had not even graduated from Hopkins. And I left there as a sophomore and came back as an associate professor with tenure.
With tenure. But you didn't you give that up to work on Plowshares?
I gave it up after 3 years to work on Poetry Magazine in Chicago.
Poetry Magazine.
They needed an editor. And they were in the process of letting Hayden Carruth, who was a very good poet, go as editor. And they asked me if I wanted the job, so I took that job. I had that for about 5 years.
Why give up a safe teaching job with tenure to take a job like that? Which
That's
is
a good
risky.
Question. I don't know the answer.
what happened with that magazine?
Well, I edited the magazine for 5 years, and it went bankrupt. And I think partly due to my handling of it. There was no foundation money in those days. This was in the early 50s.
You were probably paying the poets too much money.
I think we paid them 50 cents a line, which was a lot of money in those days. But then I had to get another job, so I went back to teaching, not at Hopkins, but I went out to California as a visitor, and then went to the University of Nebraska, and I was there 10 years.
Oh, that's where you took over Plowshares.
Yeah, that was the magazine called Prairie Schooner, which was a good
Prairie
magazine.
Oh, Prairie Schooner, yeah. I thought it was Plowshares.
I think I changed the name in this book. I think I called it Tracks West or something like that.
Well, see, you're ahead of yourself. You're telling me about things in this book.
No, not in this book. It's in the subsequent.
That's right, and these other editions haven't come out yet. But it was Prairie. I thought it was Plowshares. But I can see why I could get confused. I see in the... And about the author here, it was Prairie Schooner. You edited that until 1966. Are you teaching in California now?
I retired 3 years ago. I taught there almost 20 years.
University of California?
Yeah, the campus in Davis.
Uh-huh.
And we still live in Davis. We have a house there. But I don't do any teaching anymore. I gave it up. You can still teach if you're retired, but I'd had enough.
But you're still writing poetry.
Yeah.
Does it ever reach a point that a poet runs out of something to say?
Well, there are many, many instances of poets who stop writing. I've never believed in the idea of the decaying talent, which critics have a penchant for, and biographers. I had a wonderful letter one time from a junior high school girl who wrote, she said, my English teacher said, we are to write a paper about you, and I would like to know about where you were born, your education, your publications, and your decline. And I thought, this is the way the public's mind works that way. But then, as you get older, you're supposed to get senile, and your work is, if you're an athlete, you can't be a pitcher when you're 45. So, but I've never, in my look at the lives and writings of poets and other artists, I've never really been convinced that this is a pattern. I think it happens in many cases. In many other cases, it doesn't. And with artists, there was a German poet who was a doctor, Gottfried Benn, wrote a very good article about the poets of old age or the artists of old age. He gave long lists of famous artists from the Renaissance on who did their best work in their 80s and 90s. And I don't know whether I have a point to make or not.
Well, I think your point is that you can't tell where somebody will peak as an artist. It could happen at an early age, a middle age, an old age. It could happen any time. But I've been reading some biographies of famous writers recently, which are a little irritating. Biographies of Tennessee Williams and Truman Capote come to mind, in which the biographers said, well, Capote never reached his potential, or... Tennessee Williams really, he had some major successes, great dramas, the American theater, and then his decline. And he never really did what he should have done. Well, how does anybody know that? I mean, how can you take away the great plays of Truman, of Tennessee Williams? And you're talking about a lifetime. Or Capote, how does that biographer know that Capote never met his potential? I mean, he's written some wonderful books and established wonderful characters. If I had the talent of Truman Capote, I mean, that would all I would need. I would want somebody harping on this. Why didn't you do more? Why didn't you do better? Why don't you keep pumping what you did 10 years ago out? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I'm bothered by that, too. A lot of contemporary biographies are really bashing books. I mean, even when they're carefully done. I had a poem in the New Yorker last month about Tennyson. I would never have written that poem if it hadn't been for a biography that I read, a man named Roger Martin. Now, it's a big, heavy tome, absolute detail, and very convincing. You never doubt anything that he says. But
the biography
underneath
of it,
it's a biography of Tennyson. But
oh,
underneath
Tennyson.
Of it, there's a kind of a running criticism, which is really a denigration. Well, I read this huge book twice, and it somehow got in my blood, and I ended up writing a poem. And my poem about Tennyson, I think, did the same thing that this biographer did unintentionally. I really liked Tennyson. He's one of the great lyric poets of the world. But I found myself writing about, I mean, it's, the first line of the poem is, like many of us, he was rather disgusting. And then I never knew all this disgusting stuff about Tennyson. It's not all that disgusting anyway. He was stingy and he loved to parade around in costumes, you know, like Cambridge degree gowns and things like this.
Well, I think that's what they're doing now. They're writing biographies showing all the warts, which I don't know is necessarily bad. It does shed a light on what the artist is and how he became what he is. You use the term bashing, and to a degree I think you're right, but it's also fascinating to look at both the quirks as well as the successes of a famous literary person that you admire. Well, Carl Shapiro, you certainly are a poetic treasure. I'm going to be very anxious. I hope Algonquin will send me the subsequent volumes so I can find out in detail what happens
next. Well, I hope they print them.
I have a taste now, so I want to find out more. It was really wonderful having the chance to meet you. Thank you very, very much.
Well, thank you.